All right, let's jump into a deep dive today into Micah chapter 1. And to guide us, we've got some excerpts from Dr. Perry Phillips's lecture series, Micah, Prophet Outside the Beltway. You know, I always find it fascinating how these ancient texts still have something to say to us today, and Micah's no exception.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, to really like grasp the weight of his message, though. Yeah, we need to understand the historical and geographical, the theological backdrop. Micah wasn't just like, you know, ranting into the void. His words were deeply rooted in the realities of his time, in his world.
Okay, so let's unpack that a bit. Dr. Phillips kind of paints this picture of the 8th century BC, a time of like, you know, major political and social unrest. We're talking about the divided kingdoms of Israel and Judah.
Right.
With Samaria and Jerusalem as their capital.
Right, exactly. Both kingdoms were grappling with internal struggles, rampant idolatry and injustice, all while facing this looming threat from the Assyrian Empire. So it was a pressure cooker of a situation.
So imagine Micah, this prophet from the small town of Moresheth, right in the middle of this chaos. Dr. Phillips points out that Moresheth was in the Shephelah region, you know, like the sort of buffer zone between the coast and the Judean hills.
Right. And his location is crucial. Being from the Shephelah gave Micah this unique perspective.
Mm.
You know, it's like he was standing on a fault line, witnessing the vulnerability of both kingdoms, and almost like sensing the tremors of that approaching Assyrian earthquake.
And then he bursts onto the scene with this dramatic call to attention. Hear, you peoples, all of you, pay attention, O earth, and all that is in it. Talk about a mic drop moment. It's like he's commanding everyone to just stop and listen.
Yeah, I mean, this opening just sets the tone for the entire prophecy. Mike is not, you know, mincing words here. He's basically framing his message as a covenant lawsuit, with God as the plaintiff, calling out the Israelites for this blatant breach of contract.
And the evidence, I mean, God himself is the star witness, laying out the case against both Israel and Judah. And what's really striking is the imagery he uses to depict God's judgment. Melting mountains, valleys splitting apart. It's apocalyptic, almost like a cosmic echo of the Red Sea parting.
Right. Yeah, and that's exactly the point. Micah wants to emphasize the sheer magnitude of God's power, the gravity of this situation. These aren't just empty threats. The very foundations of their world are about to be shaken.
And the reason for this divine reckoning, Dr. Phillips points to the rampant idolatry in both Israel and Judah, but he doesn't just state it as a fact. He actually connects it to this powerful metaphor.
Yeah, he equates idolatry with adultery and prostitution, you know, transforming this seemingly like, you know, abstract theological concept into a deeply, deeply personal and emotional betrayal. It's like, you know, he's saying that turning away from God is akin to infidelity, like a breach of trust in the most, you know, the most sacred of relations.
So Samaria, known for its ivory palaces and lavish lifestyle, is the first to face judgment. Micah's prophecy, you know, paints this very stark picture of this once proud city being reduced to rubble, its treasures carried off to Assyrian temples, just a complete reversal of fortune.
Yeah. But here's the thing, though. Micah's prophecy, while it focuses on Samaria's downfall, it has a broader message. You know, it's like a warning shot across the bow for Judah, foreshadowing the vulnerability of Jerusalem itself.
It's like he's saying, hey, Judah, you're next. And to really hammer home his message, he employs this really fascinating literary technique, wordplay, almost like puns. He kind of twists the meanings of city names to highlight their impending doom.
Yeah, this is where Micah's creativity shines through. Take, for instance, Telet-Nut and Gath. The word tell echoes the Hebrew word for Gath. So it creates this poignant irony where the very act of warning against sharing the news becomes intertwined with the name of the city itself.
It's like he's turning their identity against them. And he does something similar with Bethlah Ophrah, which means house of dust, connecting it to, like, you know, the act of mourning. It's both clever and heartbreaking at the same time.
Yeah, it really is. And then there's Shafir, meaning pleasant. And Micah prophesies that it will be anything but pleasant, you know, with its inhabitants facing shame and exile. It's almost as if the name itself becomes this cruel joke, highlighting the contrast between its former glory and its impending ruin.
It's like a verbal gut punch, making his listeners confront the gravity of their situation. And speaking of gut punches, there's one city that gets a particularly chilling warning, Lachish. A strategically vital city, Micah calls it the beginning of sin to the daughter of Zion, directly linking its fate to the vulnerability of Jerusalem itself.
Right. And this is where history and archaeology actually intersect in a really fascinating way.
Mm-hmm.
Dr. Phillips points to the siege reliefs found in Sennacherib's palace, now housed in the British Museum, which actually depict the brutal conquest of Lachish.
So we're not just talking about like abstract prophecies, but actual historical events backed by visual evidence. It just makes Micah's words all the more powerful, knowing that these pronouncements actually came true.
Yeah, precisely. It's this stark reminder that these weren't just, you know, words on a scroll. These were real events with devastating consequences. And, you know, what makes it even more impactful is that Micah doesn't even shy away from prophesying the fall of his own hometown, Moresheth-Tagath.
It's like he's saying, no one is exempt from judgment, not even me. It's just this really stark realization that underscores the universal nature of the coming crisis. But amidst all this doom and gloom, there's this surprisingly tender moment, Micah's lament.
Right, right. Despite knowing that their judgment is deserved, he's genuinely heartbroken by the destruction that he foresees. He cries out, "For this I will lament and wail. I will go stripped and naked. I will make lamentation like the jackals and mourning like the ostriches."
This image of Micah stripped bare and wailing is so raw and visceral. Dr. Phillips connects it to the practice of wearing sackcloth and ashes. This traditional expression of grief and repentance found throughout the Bible, it's a powerful reminder that prophets aren't just like, you know, emotionless robots. They're real people who feel deeply.
It's a profound insight into Micah's humanity, his empathy for the very people that he's prophesying against. He's not this detached observer. He's a heartbroken participant in this, you know, in this unfolding drama. And in that heartbreak, we get this glimpse of the tension between God's justice and his love.
So at this point, things seem pretty bleak. Is there any hope to be found in Micah's prophecy?
Well, there is. Even in the midst of judgment, Micah offers this glimmer of hope. He points to this future ruler who will arise from Bethlehem, whose goings forth are from of old, from everlasting.
It's this intriguing hint at a coming Messiah, a beacon of light in the encroaching darkness.
Right. Yeah, it really is a promise that even amidst, you know, devastation, God's ultimate plan for redemption and restoration is still in motion.
Yeah.
And this promise, you know, it's echoed throughout the Hebrew Bible. It's a reminder that God's story is bigger than our immediate circumstances.
So even when things look their bleakest, there's always that thread of hope woven through. Mm. But before we delve deeper into that hope, I want to go back to Micah's description of Samaria's judgment for a second. There's this powerful image of the city's foundations being laid bare.
Right, right. And Dr. Phillips points out that Micah connects this to the concept of exposed nakedness. It's not just about physical destruction. It's about the shame of being stripped bare, both literally and metaphorically.
So it's like their sin, their idolatry has left them vulnerable and exposed. And I can't help but think about that chilling comparison to prostitution, with Samaria's ill-gotten gains ending up in the idolatrous temples of Assyria. It's like this twisted cycle of corruption.
Yeah, it is. Micah is highlighting the perversion of true worship. How idolatry leads to this devaluing of human life and a distortion of right relationships. It's a stark warning against compromising our values for temporary gain.
Yeah, it's a reminder that the consequences of our actions ripple outward, impacting not just ourselves, but those around us as well. But going back to Micah's use of wordplay for a second, it's almost like he's playing a dangerous game, using humor to deliver these pronouncements of doom.
Yeah, there's definitely a subversive element to it, yeah. but it's more than just, you know, clever wordplay. Micah is employing these linguistic tools to make his message memorable, to shake people out of their complacency.
He's playing with their expectations. Like when he talks about Shafir, meaning pleasant, and how its inhabitants will experience anything but pleasantness as they face shame and exile.
Right. That's the irony that he's masterfully employing. And then there's Zainan, a name that sounds like the Hebrew for come out. Yet Micah prophesies its people will be too terrified to even leave their city walls.
It's as if the city's very name becomes a mockery of its fate. And we see it again with Bethazel, meaning house of taking away, which, as Micah foretells, is ultimately taken away by the enemy.
Right. He uses language to create these layers of meaning and impact.
Yeah.
You know, it's like he's turning the names of these cities into mini prophecies, embedding these warnings within their very identity.
But it's not just about, you know, clever wordplay. There's a deeper purpose at work here, right?
Oh, absolutely. Micah's forcing his audience to think critically, to question their assumptions about security and permanence. He's trying to wake them up to the reality of their situation.
And that brings us back to Micah's personal lament. It's just this raw outpouring of grief. Even though he knows this, he knows that this judgment is coming.
Right. Yeah, his cry of, you know, for this I will lament and wail, I will go stripped and naked, I will make lamentation like the jackals and mourning like the ostriches. It's gut-wrenching. It really highlights the tension between recognizing the need for justice and experiencing the pain of its consequences.
He's not celebrating this judgment. It's causing him genuine sorrow.
Exactly. And it humanizes him. You know, he's not this detached oracle, but someone who is deeply affected by the fate of his people. Dr. Phillips notes that Micah's lament echoes that of other biblical figures like Jeremiah, even Jesus, who wept over Jerusalem.
Yeah, it reminds us that empathy and compassion can exist even amidst pronouncements of judgment. And it allows us to connect with Micah on this deeper level. Like, he's giving us permission to grieve the brokenness we see in the world.
Absolutely. And it raises these important questions about the nature of prophecy itself. You know, challenges that notion that prophets are simply mouthpieces for divine pronouncements. They're complex individuals grappling with the weight of their calling, experiencing the full spectrum of human emotions.
So Micah's prophecy isn't just about doom and gloom, fire and brimstone. It's about the messy, complicated intersection of human experience and divine justice. It's about grappling with these difficult truths while holding on to hope.
Precisely.
Yeah.
And speaking of hope, let's turn our attention back to that glimmer of light that Micah offers, that final verse where he hints at a future ruler from Bethlehem.
The one whose goings forth are from of old, from everlasting. It's like like this beacon of hope piercing through the darkness, reminding us that judgment isn't the final word.
Right. Micah's prophecy, while firmly rooted in his present reality, also points towards a future restoration.
It suggests that even as we face the consequences for our actions, God's ultimate plan for redemption is still in motion.
And that leads us to a crucial question. How does this ancient prophecy, with its warnings and promises, speak to us today? How can we apply Micah's message to our modern lives?
Yeah, that is the question, isn't it? How can a text written, you know, thousands of years ago in a totally different context, how can that still hold meaning for us today? What can we glean from Micah's prophecy that we can actually, like, apply to our, you know, 21st century lives?
Well, I think it's about looking beyond the surface level, beyond just the historical specifics.
Yeah.
And tapping into those timeless truths that Micah is grappling with. Truths about human nature, our relationship with the divine, justice and mercy, the consequences of our choices, you know.
Yeah, one thing that really struck me was Micah's prophecy about the fall of his own hometown, Moresheth-Gath. It's like he's holding up a mirror to himself saying, look, no one is exempt from judgment, not even me, the prophet.
That's such a powerful point. It speaks to the universality of Micah's message.
Yeah.
He's not just, you know, pointing fingers at others. He's implicating himself in this collective need for repentance and change. Mm. It's a reminder that accountability starts with looking inward.
No hiding behind privilege or status. We all have to answer for our actions, regardless of who we are or where we come from. But how do we translate these ancient concepts of sin and judgment into a modern context? I mean, it's not like we're bowing down to golden statues anymore.
Right. But Micah's message goes deeper than just the literal act of idol worship. You know, he's addressing this fundamental human tendency, the tendency to place things, ideas, even people above our relationship with the divine. It's about misplaced priorities, allowing things to consume us, mm-hmm. to become the driving force in our lives.
So modern day idols could be anything from wealth and power to the pursuit of, you know, status or comfort. Even good things like family or career. Those can become idols if we allow them to take precedence over our commitment to God's values.
Exactly. You know, it's about recognizing what truly holds our allegiance, what dictates our decisions, shapes our actions. And Micah warns us that just as ancient Israel and Judah faced consequences for their misplaced loyalty, so too will we experience the fallout from prioritizing anything above our relationship with the divine.
And those consequences aren't always like immediate or dramatic. It's not like a bolt of lightning strikes us down every time we make a bad choice.
Right. The consequences can be more subtle.
Yeah.
But no less damaging. You know, fractured relationships. A persistent sense of emptiness. A feeling of being lost and directionless. It's like we become slaves to these idols.
Yeah.
Constantly striving for fulfillment. But never quite finding it.
So Micah's message is this call to examine our hearts, to identify those things that we've allowed to take center stage, and to consciously realign our priorities with God's values.
So recognizing the subtle ways we've allowed ourselves to be pulled off course.
Yeah.
And then making the conscious choice to turn back, to reorient our lives towards what truly matters. Mm-hmm. But Micah doesn't stop there. He goes beyond just, you know, individual transformation and calls for a radical restructuring of society itself.
He rails against the corruption, the oppression, the blatant disregard for the poor and vulnerable in this society. And that resonates deeply with us today as we face our own set of systemic injustice.
Absolutely. Micah's message is a call to action, a challenge to not just sit back and bemoan the state of the world, mm-hmm. but to actively participate in bringing about positive change. It's about fighting for justice, advocating for the marginalized, holding those in power accountable. It's about recognizing that our faith shouldn't just be confined to our personal lives. It should spill over into the public sphere, influencing how we engage with our communities and the world at large.
It's a powerful reminder that we're not just, you know, passive bystanders in this unfolding drama of history. We have a responsibility to be agents of change, to embody God's love and justice in tangible ways. And that brings us back to that glimmer of hope, that promise of a future ruler from Bethlehem, whose goings forth are from of old, from everlasting.
Even amidst the pronouncements of judgment, Micah offers this glimpse of a future restoration, a future where God's ultimate plan for redemption will be realized. It's a reminder that even when things seem bleak, even when we feel overwhelmed by the darkness, God is still at work. He is still weaving together those threads of hope, inviting us to participate in the grand tapestry of his unfolding story.
So Micah's prophecy isn't just a historical artifact, like a dusty scroll, you know, relegated to the shelves of academia. It's a living, breathing message that speaks to the deepest longings of the human heart, the longing for justice, for meaning, for hope. Yeah. It challenges us to confront our own shortcomings, to actively participate in building a better world, and to hold fast to the promise that even in the darkest of times, God's love and mercy will ultimately prevail.
It's a message that can inspire us, challenge us, and ultimately guide us towards a life of greater purpose and meaning.
So as we wrap up our deep dive into Micah chapter 1, we invite you to consider these questions. What are the modern day idols that you might be clinging to? What are the injustices you see in the world that you feel called to address? And how can you, in your own unique way, be a part of God's ongoing work of redemption and restoration? Thanks for joining us. Until next time, keep seeking, keep questioning, and keep diving deeper into the truths that set us free.